The Healthy Alabama podcast is sponsored by Enroll Alabama, a program that enrolls Alabamians in the health insurance marketplace. Navigators provide free local in-person support to all applicants. Enroll Alabama, 256-432-7494, 256-432-7494.
Welcome to another edition of the Healthy Alabama podcast. I'm David Person. This podcast is produced in partnership with WJOU 90.1 FM in Huntsville, Alabama, and is sponsored by Enroll Alabama. I'm glad to have back in the studio for another discussion my good friend Dr. Ron Wyatt, who, if you caught the previous podcast episode, you know that Ron is helping to design and implement a public health care system for the nation of Qatar or Qatar. Ron, it is good to have you here for the Healthy Alabama podcast.
Thanks, Davis. Always good to see you. Good to be home.
Yeah, good to see you too. Glad that you're able to get these, I guess we'll call them furloughs, where you can come back home every once in a while and spend time, and then you go back.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. So let's talk in this episode, Ron. Let's talk about one of your passions, which is also a passion of mine, in large part because you kind of helped to, you know, help me to understand the issues of health disparities, and I want to really talk about. I want to talk about it broadly, but then I also want us to talk about the indications of health disparities in your home state here, Alabama. Mm-hmm. I think it's especially germane because of where you grew up. And for folks who may have missed the previous podcast episode, you grew up in Perry County, Alabama.
I grew up in Perry County on Highway 29 out in the sticks, as they say.
Yeah. And you guys had no indoor plumbing.
Right.
And what else?
So we didn't have heating. We had fireplace, wood-burning stove. We drank well water, outhouses, and we were dirt poor. But even with that, we had cousins and relatives who were even worse off than we were. I recall having cousins who lived in what we would think of as a shanty, really. Mm-hmm. And they didn't, the floor was dirt, and it was packed so tight that they could sweep the floor.
Wow.
A dirt floor that you could sweep.
And this was in the 1960s?
This was in late 60s into the mm-hmm. 70s, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Perry County.
So when you were growing up in Perry County, were you... And, of course, this was before, you know, you went to Morehouse and then medical school and all that. But were you aware of health disparities that existed when you were growing up there?
Yeah, I was. And it really was why I wanted to go into medicine in the first place. So I recall having going to Greensboro, Alabama, to a general practitioner. And the waiting rooms were segregated, so black folks could not get appointments. You would show up knowing that you would pretty much spend the day there.
Wow.
And
this was in the late 60s, early 70s?
This was late 60s, early 70s.
Wow.
I recall my relatives literally packing a lunch because you knew you'd have to stay and wait all day. And the physician would see the black patients in between slow periods of seeing the white patients that came in. So you can start to think about what kind of health care was being, you know, being delivered. And the big driver was when the man who raised me, Tom Cannon, had that same kind of delay in treatment, and I happened to be home from college, that ultimately led to his death. He died from a ruptured appendix after we waited all day to be seen by a physician in Greensboro, Alabama, who said he's too sick, take him to Selma, and he died in the hospital in Selma, really having not even been seen by a physician.
Wow. That's sad and tragic. And a little infuriating. I know even for me, not you know, being removed from the family connection, but still just hearing that, it's that's an outrage.
Yeah, it's disgraceful. Unfortunately, not rare, I would say. Even today, delays in treatment based on something is not rare.
Not rare in the state of Alabama, not rare nationally? What
yeah.
do you mean?
Yeah, not rare in the state of Alabama or nationally. So when we start to think about the problem of disparity, we need to think about what that means. So we always start with some, let's just start with some basic definition of disparity, which is in healthcare really a more scientific term. It really relates to some difference in outcome, health outcome, for some reason. So if we, even we go back to the late 1800s, William E. DuBose wrote a scientific article that's called The Philadelphia Negro. And he makes this profound statement in there as he looked at the statistical breakdown of health outcomes for black folks in Philadelphia. And he made this statement. He called it a peculiar indifference. And I think that's a good way to think about disparity, as a peculiar indifference that leads to some less than optimal outcome, which typically means death. And when we think about disparity in the U.S., it's difficult to talk about disparity without saying there is a racial disparity. And if you look at the numbers even today in the state of Alabama, you will still see when you compare black patients to white patients or populations, you see a tremendous difference in health outcomes, whether it's from heart disease or cancer or asthma or accidental death. Or infant mortality, you start to see this separation, and you start to ask, well, why does that separation exist? So that defines disparity, and then what is, and I'm going to use this word intentionally, and I'll tell you why in a second, downstream inequity. So healthcare equity then means I should be able to achieve the highest level of health that I want to achieve. And I should not be blocked from that. There should not be any barrier to me achieving the highest outcome that I want to achieve. And when I'm a patient, the level of care should be evidence-based for everyone. It should be, there should be no difference based on race, ethnicity, whatever your gender identity is, if you're disabled, if you're rural, if you're uninsured. It really should be the same. So if you hold that for a second, I guess I want people to understand what I mean. And I'll do it with just a brief story.
Okay.
That we need to start to understand how this impacts health and healthcare outcomes, not just in Alabama, but across the country. So the story goes, a man's driving home and he sees people rushing down a bank because there are babies in a creek. And people are saving these babies from the creek. And they're jumping in the water, pulling them out. This man looks, he sees the people jumping in the water to save the babies, he turns and walks away. Now you can imagine what you would think if we're trying to save lives,
right?
And this man, we need every hand we can get, mm-hmm. and this man walks away. So someone says, we need you here, why are you walking away? We need everybody. And he says, yes, we do, but in order to save the babies in the water, I need to go upstream and see who keeps throwing them in the water in the first place. So there's upstream issues that impact downstream outcomes.
Okay.
So when we think about what those upstream issues are, what is up on the bridge throwing people's lives in the water, allowing them to drown or to partially drown or to be faced with some chronic illness? So then we start to think about what's called non-medical determinants of health or social determinants of health. And what does that mean? And a good friend of mine, Don Irwin, down in New Orleans, would say, as he said to me, it's the stuff that's killing us. And the stuff that's killing us is things like poverty. It's living conditions. It's lack of education. It's lack of access to quality health care. So when people think about disparity, you just talk about, well, we have access to health care. Yes, we do. The issue becomes, what happens to me once I have access? Are the right decisions being made for me? Am I being diagnosed and treated in an assiduous way based on evidence-based practice like anyone else would? So you start to address all those upstream things that leads to these downstream bad things that, happen that ultimately result in premature death for primarily in the state of Alabama for black folks.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to make sure that we clarified. I know you and Dr. David Williams at Harvard have worked together and in conjunction with other people on the issue of health inequities and health disparities, specifically as it relates to race.
Right.
But it sounds as though from what you just said, there are economic factors as well that create these disparities. So which is the most prevalent in terms of creating disparities, race or economics?
Yeah. So it's hard to pull them apart. But the truth is this, it's race. So what David has looked at and what I've looked at is what happens in this healthcare system to a black person who has the best insurance and a white person who is uninsured, right? The science says that the white person uninsured still gets a better outcome. So how can you explain that then? One of the studies that was done on heart disease, white patient, black patient, same demographic, same level of education, same income level. Everything is the same. Symptoms are the same. Same job. Cardiologists were asked, what would you do for one patient versus the other? In the study, the white patient got the more aggressive intervention. The black patient did not. So you start to ask, well, how do you explain that? Now, typically, studies will say, well, we need more research to understand it. What Dave and I will say, no, we really don't. There's something else operating that leads to these differences in clinical decision-making that leads to some difference in a decision that's made that can impact a person's life. So what we look at then is if it's racism, then how is that express, and we start to talk about institutional racism, structural racism, the impact of what's called implicit bias that we can talk about, and I'll just kind of pause there.
Well, I think you're going with implicit bias. I think you're going where I wanted to go, which is to examine this breed of racism, because we're not necessarily talking about neo-Nazi doctors or KKK
right.
doctors.
Right.
We're talking about people who probably don't consider themselves racist and probably, by conventional definition, are not racist.
Right.
But they have, as you just said, an implicit bias as it relates to health care for black people and white people. I know one example that you and I have discussed and I've discussed with other experts is that the perception is that black people have a higher tolerance of pain
right.
than white people. This
right.
is a prevalent perception right. in the medical community, right?
Right, right. right. So there's been studies to look at even if the person has sickle cell anemia and is in a sickle cell crisis, that person receives less pain management than a white person who is not in a sickle cell crisis. And there's all kind of theories related to that, the thickness of the skin, there's all kind of things that really don't make sense, which comes back to, well, this has to be something different operating. There has to be something operating at a subconscious level that leads to one decision being made for one group and another decision being made for another group. And it happens at this implicit level that you can test it and see that it truly does exist.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to understand how we can use that to undo it without saying, yeah, Dr. X, you're a racist. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about structural and institutional things that are put in place that leads to different decisions being made and how we undo those. Some is as simple as, why don't we have more black kids in medical school? Why don't we have more black researchers, or et cetera? So starting to break down all of those, who makes the policies? Who makes the procedures? Who writes the laws and regulations that can cause differences in outcomes in healthcare? So you break down the different kinds of biases and prejudices involved. Now, some of them are just explicit, And in practice, I've experienced explicit bias and what's called micro assaults and micro insults. So, for instance, you know, people ask me, well, how'd you get into medical school? Was it on a quota? Or you really are eloquent. You're really a good speaker. As one physician said, until I met you, I had no idea you were black. Well, that's implicit. Mm-hmm. Right. That doesn't mean that person's a racist, but something is happening.
Well, they hold the stereotypes.
Stereotypes really play into it. Mm-hmm. Because they're not, what he's saying to me wasn't an intentional way to hurt me, but it plays out in decisions that are made that truly can impact a person's life.
Well, it suggests that there are a lot of people who, while they don't, and I think it's important, especially in the African American community, that we get this distinction. There are a lot of people that don't hate black people as a group.
Right.
They don't hate black people.
Right.
But they certainly, I believe that there are people who certainly believe, and I've even had at least one white person say to me in a forum that they believe that culturally we are inferior. Mm-hmm. That our culture is innately inferior. Mm-hmm. They believe these are people that I would say are supremacists. They're white supremacists.
Yeah.
They believe that their culture is better than our culture simply because it's white.
Yeah.
And I think there are and I think this carries into some of the stereotyping that you're talking about, that mm-hmm. there are people who believe, while they don't hate people, mm-hmm. they still believe these people or that are inferior because of their culture or their circumstances, or maybe even because they believe that biologically there's something that is innately inferior in people who are of African descent as opposed to people of European descent.
Right, and this is historical. So it's important, again, that we understand the history. There's a really terrific book that's called Medical Apartheid that goes back and looks at the history of this. And you can go back to some of the things you're saying all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, who studied black folks and said, well, black folks have smaller skulls, therefore they're not as smart. Right? Mm. And you work that up through medical experimentation that we all know about here in Alabama with the syphilis studies.
Yeah.
But there are many studies that preceded that. The so-called father of gynecology, Dr. Marion Sims, Montgomery, Alabama, who in essence experimented with unanesthetized young black women mm-hmm. to perfect gynecological surgery. And he has a statue outside of the Institutes of Health in New York City mm-hmm. saying he's the father of gynecology. And in fact, what he did was impact pain and suffering on young black women to perfect his techniques.
And subsequently caused many of them to be sterile.
Absolutely
right?
did. He absolutely did. The use of ether for anesthesia was first attempted on a young black kid until it was perfected. The birth control was tested on Puerto Rican women with tremendous negative outcomes until it was perfected. Then you go through the syphilis studies. You come up to Henrietta Lacks and how her cells have led to tremendous discoveries in health and healthcare. And those cells were taken from Henrietta Lacks without her permission, without the family's knowledge. So you have this history.
And God bless Oprah Winfrey, by the way, for doing a great HBO movie on Henrietta Lacks.
And then you go to how medical school admissions were handled and how the selection of research grants are handled by the National Institutes of Health, and the numbers don't lie. You start to see how black researchers don't get as many research grants from the NIH. You begin to see that the numbers of black kids that go to medical school and not just get admitted, but the numbers that ultimately graduate start to decline. Same for any healthcare profession and black folks. Nursing, pharmacy, dental, the numbers bear out that there's something else operating that we need to better understand in a country truly where the demographics are changing.
Right. So health disparities, health inequities shouldn't be a shock based on everything that you're saying.
Should not be a shock.
It's a byproduct of all of these things.
Right.
When it comes to the state of Alabama, and specifically as someone who is a native of Perry County, Alabama, do you see vast improvement from over the past 40 years, you know, from when you were growing up 40 to 50 years when you were growing up in the state of Alabama? Do you see vast improvement today, or do you think we still have a very serious problem with health disparities?
Yeah, you know, it might be an overstatement, but I'll say it. I think we have in the state of Alabama and throughout the Southeast an existential crisis in health care. There was a recent article in Harper's this past summer, and the title of the article was "The Place Where Healthcare Won't Go," and it's Perry County, Alabama. A couple years ago, there was an outbreak of active tuberculosis in Marion, Alabama. That is unheard of.
So we're talking about 2015 or
yes.
So. Okay.
That's just unheard of in a first world country, that you would have that kind of outbreak of active tuberculosis. So you start to try to understand why that could be. That led me to call the physician in Marion to ask him about this problem. And I just said, you know, I'm from there. Can I come to Marion? Is there something I can do to help you? And he said something to me that stuck with me. He said, you know, there's a lot of press around the outbreak of tuberculosis. There was a New York Times article that talked about the syphilis studies from Tuskegee. He said, but the same weekend that this news hit, two of his patients, young black men in their late 40s, early 50s, died from strokes because they couldn't afford a blood pressure medicine. So you start to look at, again, the leading cause of death in Alabama and Perry County in the U.S. is heart disease. So you ask yourself, what's cheaper, to provide a person with health care and affordable medications, or managing the after effects of a stroke if the person doesn't die? And the truth is, most people who have a stroke won't die from it, but they have now some permanent disability that they have to be cared for. You ask yourself, when we get back to the economy and the cost, what's cheaper? Make sure a person has a blood pressure medicine that costs maybe $5 a month, right? Or wait until they have a stroke and now you have a person who is disabled. We have to think about this differently. There's no reason in the state of Alabama that the infant mortality rate for black women, infants, is twice the national average. That is a third world number. It is absolutely unacceptable. And if you look at even infant mortality rate for black and white in Alabama, it's higher than the national average. Why is that? And then you start to break it down, whether it's heart disease or diabetes or all of the major killers of people. When you look at the numbers in Alabama versus the nation, they all exceed the national average. And the one that in the last couple of years has absolutely skyrocketed is the number of deaths in Alabama. Over 80% of the deaths from opiate overdose are white people, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a public health crisis that needs to be addressed. The largest, fastest growing population of people going to prison in the state of Alabama are poor white women who are drug addicted. That's a public health crisis. So then you go back upstream and say, what is it that's driving this? What is it that in a state you have more money going to the prison system than to education? More advanced countries put their investments in two places, healthcare and education, not in prisons, right? So what is it here that's driving these issues? The number one, I think, is poverty. It's income inequality and poverty. It's an education system that needs to be more robust, that leads to people living healthier lives. So the message has to go from making the money downstream to putting the investment upstream, which is in healthier lifestyles, it's in prevention, it's in education around health care, the issues related to smoking, to alcohol, to obesity. In Alabama a few years ago, I met with a vice president at Blue Cross of Alabama, and he said that over 80% of the money that Blue Cross pays out in the state of Alabama is somehow directly linked to obesity. So that's an issue that cuts across all income levels,
right,
and strata.
Right.
And that's something that you can start to think about. How can we prevent this? How can we decrease the rate of obesity? Because if you got a kid that's obese at 10 or 12, they're going to be a diabetic in their 20s. And then in their 40s, they're going to have heart disease and problems with their circulation, strokes, heart attacks, nerve damage in their 40s. So we have to start to think now about what is it that's driving this. That in this case goes beyond race, because it's white and black.
Right.
It's just that when you look at the black population in the state, it's most of the race are double worse than the white population. So how can a state have a viable workforce, a healthy workforce, when you underneath that is being driven by such unhealthy outcomes? It has to be addressed, and I think has to be addressed in an urgent way.
In the minute or so that we have left, what is that urgent way? Yeah. What needs to happen?
Yeah. So there is, for me, healthcare is not a privilege; it is a right. It is for me unacceptable to say that there's anyone anywhere in any state that doesn't have health insurance, right? And access to primary care, access to preventive services, access to screening services, access to education around what a healthy lifestyle looks like across the entire spectrum. And then for me, if I were going to say, how do we redirect resources? For me, it's redirect those resources from downstream to upstream. Focus on healthy lifestyles. Focus on children. Focus on the proper diet and exercise in the school system. How do we build healthy communities? Are there places in the community where people can exercise? They can walk. They have public transportation that's reliable, that there are more fresh produce on the corner versus convenience stores. So you start to address it really in a more global way. And again, part of my work here in Alabama was going to Birmingham, and I asked the disparities program, if you had a $10 million grant, what would you do with it? And the person I talked to said, everywhere there's a convenience store across the street from an elementary school or middle school, I would put up a stand and give the kids fresh fruit and produce every day when they went home. So it's starting to look at the community level, which is what population health is. How can we build healthier, more vibrant communities versus waiting until people get sick to say, now let's do something about it?
Again, another conversation that we could go easily another 30 minutes to an hour discussing all of the aspects of this topic. Dr. Ron Wyatt, I want to thank you once again for being with us for the Healthy Alabama podcast. Dr. Wyatt is a native of Perry County, Alabama, as you heard him say, Morehouse grad, University of Alabama graduate, Harvard graduate, and has served the nation, really, overseeing military hospitals and with the Joint Commission accrediting hospitals. And now is we've loaned him to the nation of Qatar, where he is helping to build a public health system there. Dr. Wyatt, thank you.
Thank you. Good to be home.
All right. The Healthy Alabama podcast is sponsored by Enroll Alabama and produced in partnership with WJOU 90.1 FM in Huntsville, Alabama. The theme music was created and produced and performed by Dejon Bailey. I'm David Person, host and producer. Until next time, be healthy.